From Iowa to New York, Maryland to Texas, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, free markets and competition have resulted in the USA having the best broadband infrastructure in the world. Bill Kirpin from American Commitment is here to explain why the government should not get involved. A new nationwide survey finds rapidly rising support for giving parents more school choice options for their K-12 students. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Both Social Security and Medicare are facing insolvency much sooner than previously forecast. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine has details. And Utah consistently ranks as the best-run state in the nation in the annual Rich States, Poor States report. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has an American Radio Journal commentary on how they did it. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. While much of the nation's infrastructure is in disrepair, broadband service is the one area where we're doing rather well. That's because it is largely handled by the private sector. Phil Kirpin is president of American Commitment. He is here to talk about why government should resist the urge to get involved. Phil, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Phil, when we talk about infrastructure, of course, most people think about roads, bridges, maybe airports and railways, but infrastructure has really come to include broadband as well, has it not?
Certainly has, and I think it's very different from those other things you mentioned in that we've done really well with broadband infrastructure. We're probably the best in the world. Certainly during COVID, when Europe was throttling traffic with maybe a hiccup here and there, we performed very admirably. But it somehow has become the centerpiece of a lot of the infrastructure discussion in Washington, the idea that somehow more government involvement will make the internet better than what I've seen as a pretty good success to this point. So I'm worried that they'll muck it up and make it look more like roads and bridges and water and sewer and some of the things that haven't worked as well. But it was heavily funded in the COVID relief bill. It's one of the recommended uses for all the money that went to states and localities and that. And it looks like there's going to be another big pot of taxpayer money for broadband in the infrastructure bill, the one that's already passed the Senate.
When you say it was heavily funded in the bill, more money's to come, who and what exactly is being or proposed to be funded with those dollars?
The money that already went out in the COVID bill, it was $350 billion to states and localities, and it has a wide variety of recommended uses. Among them is broadband. So that's one of the many things that money can be spent on, and that's a massive amount of money. I'm sure you're seeing it there at your local governments, all the money that's available for that. And then there's another, it looks like, $65 billion that'll be specifically for broadband in the infrastructure bill. And a little bit over $14 billion actually goes to a voucher program for lower-income people to get, I think, $30 a month subsidized on their bill. So that's a demand-side subsidy, which if you're going to subsidize, it's a better way to do it than picking one given company to put the buying power into the hands of the low-income person you're trying to subsidize. But all the rest of it is basically just grants to the states, and there's no really effective requirement. Unfortunately, it looks like that it goes to unserved areas. And so, you know, without a good process to make sure that you map things out and you direct it only to unserved areas, one of my big fears is that you're going to end up overbuilding the suburbs or urban areas, places that already have service, competing with private providers, and you're still not going to reach those hard-to-reach rural areas, which are kind of driving this politically. So I think a lot of it is unfortunately going to end up being poorly targeted.
Is all that government spending actually necessary, Phil? As you mentioned, our infrastructure, our internet infrastructure, performed admirably during 2020 when it was at a high point of stress and usage. So do we really need government to be putting this amount of money into it, or is that something that the private sector seems to be handling well on its own?
Well, I think the private sector is doing extraordinarily well. And what we have that is a great benefit to America versus most other places is we've got a very strenuous competition between the phone guys and the cable guys, and increasingly there's wireless and satellite and other technologies as well, but other places don't have that. Almost everywhere else in the world, you kind of have a phone monopoly that became an internet monopoly and is heavily government regulated and sort of doesn't innovate and invest unless they're forced to or prodded to by regulators and politicians. We haven't had that. We've had a very well-functioning market that has had massive amounts of private investment, and it's been driven by competition. And so most places in America, you have at least two choices of broadband providers, and you might have three or four, and they compete heavily on speed and on price, and they advertise all the time and run specials, and consumers are sort of in a good position to get a good deal and a good value and reliable service. It's not everywhere, though, and particularly there are some hard-to-reach rural areas where the economics might just never work to build out a very high-speed connection, or at least not a wired connection. And this is why Elon Musk is deploying his satellite service, and you know, Microsoft has their own wireless technology that they're developing. And so I think that technology will probably solve the rural problem at some point. The political question is whether it'll be fast enough for the people who are complaining right now that they can't get reliable, low-cost, fast internet access, even if they're very distant from a population center. And that's what's created this political impetus for spending lots and lots of money. But Lohman, I'll tell you, we've been through, I don't know, four or five rounds of this now, and the money just never seems to actually go to those areas. It always seems to disappear into the urban and suburban areas, overbuilding them yet again, or going to a favored provider who knows somebody, or just somehow being sort of wasted. And so I'm not very optimistic. I think that to the extent we want to if we do societally want to subsidize, I like the demand side subsidy better with the voucher. But the idea of just flooding the states with money and thinking they're going to spend it wisely, I'm very suspicious of.
Is there not already a bit of a problem, Phil, with lower-income folks not even taking advantage of the lower-priced packages that are offered for internet or broadband service?
Well, that's a really good point, because almost all of the internet providers have a low-cost option that they make available for lower-income people. And typically, they set the price point so that the people in low-income categories don't really need to pay anything out of pocket, especially if they qualify for this new federal subsidy. And it's been $50 under the pandemic. This bill extends it but lowers it to $30. But I can tell you that in an area where there's a lot of competition, somebody's going to say, all right, I'll get you broadband service for $30. Give me your voucher. And that service is going to be available. The issue for a lot of kids who don't have access to internet for their homework or otherwise sort of on the wrong side of the digital divide, if they're not in a remote rural location, it's more likely that their family just didn't sign up, just didn't bother to do it, or may not have a device. And that's the other issue that isn't necessarily helped by subsidizing more service providers.
To your knowledge, have any states had a successful program to deploy any of this money?
Well, we haven't really seen a lot of it spent yet. We certainly haven't seen any in the infrastructure bill spent yet because it hasn't passed yet. But, you know, I think that the states that have had some success, and I think that the way the FCC approached this recently, because they have some similar programs also, what's been successful is when you map out, you do a map first, you find the area that you want to serve and that is currently unserved, and then you hold an auction, essentially, to see how much money you need to spend to incentivize a private company to be willing to do it. And then you have a competitive bidding process, and then you spend that amount. And that's been the FCC process for a couple of rounds now that seemed to work fairly well. What tends not to work well is when the government tries to do it for themselves and to build and run and operate a broadband network. Those have generally run up huge operating losses. So even if you had your startup costs covered by a federal grant, after a few years, you'd probably still end up trying to sell it or shut it down, because just governments have proven very bad at operating broadband networks.
We have been talking with Phil Kirpin. Phil is president of American Commitment. Phil, tell us a bit about American Commitment. Also, where can folks go to read your recent op-ed on this subject and learn more about American Commitment?
Well, we're a national free market advocacy group. We work really on all the fiscal, economic, and regulatory issues, and we try to find the fights that are on the margin, where a little bit of citizen education and engagement might make the difference and tip the outcome in a more free market direction. And all of our material is at AmericanCommitment.org.
Phil Kirpin of American Commitment. Phil, thanks again for being with us.
My pleasure.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. We're going to look outside of Washington, D.C. this week. Scott, good to have you with us.
It's great to be back, Lohman. Thanks for having me.
So you traveled to New Hampshire for a Club for Growth event that was
really focused on school choice. And Scott, with schools starting now and the whole mask mandate for school children running red hot, what sort of details emerge from this forum?
It's, I think, on the forefront of a lot of parents' minds right now, back to school, getting kids back into the normal routines that come along with K through 12 education. And if there's one thing that we've really learned over the last 18 months, I think that it's we unnecessarily really damaged a lot of the educational behavior for many students throughout the country. And the big issue here in terms of whether or not a student has access to a high-quality education has always kind of been in conservatives' minds. But when schools locked down and closed and only offered virtual learning, or maybe it was 2 days a week in some school districts in the country, a lot of different approaches in local communities. But I think that the national trend was that there was less educational opportunity for students. And so we've obviously seen in the data over the last 18 months a big shift to homeschooling and private schools that were open. And there's always been an attractive option in terms of public charter schools. So a few months ago, the Club for Growth, we decided to really survey this issue throughout the country, because school choice has always been a big issue in the conservative movement, but we feel like there's a renewed opportunity because of the coronavirus pandemic. And so we worked with the typical pollster that we use is WPA Intelligence. They probably do, I'd say, about 90% of our polling. And we commissioned them to do a new poll surrounding language within education. And you got to keep in mind that for a couple of decades, this term school choice has been beat up by education unions and teachers and those that really favor the educational institutions that are actually leaving students behind and not serving their best interests. So we pulled out a bunch of different questions, and we found that overwhelmingly the best way to actually describe what school choice is to start using this term called school freedom. And when you talk about school freedom, it just brings a different feeling to voters and persuadable voters, whether they're independents, moderates, gettable voters from the left, or just frustrated people that aren't typically voting. The survey included over 3,100 registered voters from across the country, from all political stripes, from urban areas and rural areas, suburban voters. This is, probably one of the most in-depth studies ever on school choice. And so we're going to start referring to this issue as school freedom, and we're going to start talking about the benefits of increasing educational opportunities for K through 12 students throughout America.
Across the country, Scott, over the last 3-4 weeks, as we've seen a resurgence in COVID-19, there have been, at the local school board level, a lot of debate, discussion, sometimes very heated discussion about masks and mask mandates for K-12 students. Are we finding in the school choice or school freedom movement that parents are saying, hey, look, I don't want my child to be masked up for 7 or 8 hours a day, so I'm going to choose an option where they won't have to do that? Is that also driving the school freedom movement?
I think it is. The bigger factor here is that parents were completely disgusted by virtual learning. And so if it's a choice between your student doing virtual learning at home and being around and or impeding the ability of a two-income earning family to be able to work at the same time, parents are going to choose the masking within a school. But I think that folks are also understanding the data and the science behind masks indicate that most kids aren't at risk, at least for a real severe health issue. And there obviously are anomalies throughout America that always happen when it comes to kids and their health. But the bottom line is, when you look at the national landscape, we know that this virus is one that actually comes after unhealthy people and more so the elderly.
Taking a look at how the teacher unions, Scott, have played their hand, do you think that the fact that in particularly urban areas they kept schools closed longer than was necessary, and they've put their thumb on the scale of the CDC and other things, have the unions now overplayed their hand on this whole issue?
Well, I think they have. And the reason I think that is because a lot of people don't belong to a union, and even if they think that their community or their school is great, they understand what's happened nationally. And the overall trend, the students that are being left behind, folks are waking up to that. And so what this polling actually showed was a pretty dramatic shift from January 2015 all the way through June 2021. And you're basically going from about 69% that would totally support the idea of school choice way back in 2015 all the way up to 74% now. And the strong opposition was about 27% in January 2015. Now that's only 16%. And so the unsure category has gone from 4% in 2015 up to 10%. So now people are even more open-minded. So really that 5% jump that we're seeing in strong support is actually, you should include another 6% from folks that are now really giving second thoughts about the education that their own child receives. And this spans from blacks, whites, Latinos, independents, Democrats, Republicans, people that are actually have students in public schools. It's data now that we've released and it's publicly available. The forum that we had in Concord, New Hampshire included Mike Pompeo, who has been a champion of school choice. We also included Betsy DeVos, the former Secretary of Education in our program, and we intend to do more of these school choice, school freedom forums throughout the country with national Republican voices to continue to unpack the data and really start to really tell people what school freedom means.
We are talking with Scott Parkinson. Scott, of course, is with the Club for Growth. He joins us every week here on American Radio Journal. Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
Sure. The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C., and we have over 525,000 members from all 50 states in the country. If anybody listening wants to check us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org, and you can actually become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
The latest trustees reports are out, and both Social Security and Medicare are facing insolvency sooner than was previously forecast. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine offers details.
The fiscal crisis looming over Social Security is no longer a distant threat. The national pension system will be insolvent by the time that workers now in their mid-50s are getting ready to retire. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. This week, we're taking a close look at the annual report to Congress from the trustees of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. It's a big, old, boring audit report, but it is really where all the essential information about the federal government's three big entitlement programs can be found. And while these reports have been warning about future fiscal issues for a while, this year's report, released earlier this week, is pretty grim. According to that report, the trustees for Social Security now estimate that Social Security will be unable to pay the full amount of promised benefits by 2033. That's 1 year sooner than they were projecting last year. Absent any policy changes, beneficiaries will receive just 78% of what they've been promised starting in 2034, and then there will be further cuts in future years. The pandemic caused a spike in retirements, which is why the date of Social Security's insolvency has moved up a bit. But the underlying issues with the program remain the same as they've been for decades, and the biggest problem is that the math simply doesn't add up. Social Security will see a negative cash flow of about $147 billion this year, and the deficits will only get bigger in future years as the population ages and there are fewer workers paying into the system relative to the number of retirees collecting benefits. Last year, there were 65 million Americans getting benefits from Social Security, while 175 million paid into the system via payroll taxes. That's less than three workers for every beneficiary, and it's basically a historic low for the program. Part of that problem is just basic demographics. When Social Security was launched in 1935, the average life expectancy for Americans was 61. That means the average person actually died 4 years before they qualified for benefits. Social Security was basically imagined as a safety net for the truly needy, for people who were truly in old age, but it has become a conveyor belt to transfer wealth from the younger working population to the older, relatively wealthier retired population. And people now live in retirement for much longer than they used to. The average American now lives to age 78. That's more than a decade past age 67 when they can start collecting full Social Security benefits, and it's more than a decade and a half beyond the age 62 eligibility point where early retirees can start collecting partial benefits. But if the problems facing Social Security remain the same as they always have, then the big question does too. When will Congress take action to address this imminent crisis? The last time Social Security recorded a deficit back in 1982, it spurred lawmakers to make several changes, including an increase to the payroll tax that funds Social Security to keep the program solvent for a few more decades. This time, however, there's almost no indication that either major party is prepared to act or even talk about this issue in a serious way. And the actions needed are big ones. Ensuring that Social Security will remain solvent for another 75 years, according to the trustees, would require hiking the payroll tax by 3.36 percentage points today, or making an across-the-board cut of benefits by 21%. If Congress waits until insolvency hits in the mid-2030s, then the requisite tax hike and benefit cuts would have to be 25% larger. And this is just one of the federal government's twin entitlement crises, one of the several trust funds that helps cover costs within Medicare, the old age health insurance program, is also running out of money. It's going to be insolvent in just 5 years. Starting in 2026, Medicare's Hospital Insurance Trust Fund, which covers a variety of inpatient hospital services, will be fully depleted, leaving the fund to operate on a cash flow basis, and there won't be enough cash coming in the door to pay all the bills. Instead, the program will be able to pay only about 91% of its TAB, according to Medicare's trustees report that was released this week. Without changes in how the program operates or its financing structure, that percentage will shrink in future years, leaving Medicare able to cover a smaller and smaller share of costs that ultimately are borne by hospitals. Medicare already pays less than private insurance in many cases, and it's a major payer for most hospitals. A nearly 10% reduction in payments would probably be devastating to some hospitals, especially those that serve poorer populations, many of which are already struggling to stay afloat. Like with Social Security, the problem is being made worse by a political class that's refusing to talk seriously about the trade-offs that will be required to solve the problems plaguing both entitlement programs. If anything, both of the last two presidents have promised not to solve these issues. Former President Donald Trump repeatedly insisted that he wouldn't raise taxes or reduce spending on Medicare, and during the 2016 campaign, was one of the few Republicans to say that he would pledge not to touch Social Security in any way. President Joe Biden, meanwhile, has proposed a substantial expansion of Medicare, including an array of new benefits as part of the $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation plan that is now working its way through Congress. Needless to say, Biden's plan to expand Medicare will not fix its looming fiscal woes, and spending more money at a time when the federal government needs to figure out how to save money, how to make sure that these entitlement programs can remain solvent over the long term, isn't going to address either problem. It's unlikely that either benefit cuts or tax increases alone will be able to address the problems plaguing Medicare and Social Security. It's going to have to be a combination of those two things. It's going to involve a series of difficult political and fiscal trade-offs. That's a long, tough conversation for Congress to have. It's one that Congress right now, quite frankly, doesn't seem capable of having. Congress has mostly abandoned any pretense of fiscal sanity in the last decade or so, but the math that governs Social Security and Medicare's declines are inexorable. Waiting any longer to take these problems seriously will only invite a bigger mess. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out more of our coverage of the problems with entitlements and Congress and everything else that's going on in the country this week at Reason.com, and you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Utah consistently stands out as one of the best fiscally run states in the country, and there are reasons why. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council talks about it on this American Radio Journal commentary.
For the past 14 years, I've had the privilege of authoring the annual ALEC publication, Rich States, Poor States, alongside economists Dr. Arthur Laffer and Stephen Moore. In each edition of our report, we rank the states on their economic outlook, measuring their relative economic competitiveness based on influential public policies such as taxes, regulation, and labor policies. In each and every edition of our report, the state of Utah has earned the top economic outlook ranking in America. These rankings aren't just theoretical either. Utah has kept a AAA bond rating, and more importantly, has seen an influx of new residents due to their competitive economy. In fact, the newly minted U.S. Census Bureau report on state-by-state population changes revealed that Utah was the fastest-growing state in America since the census of 2010, with a staggering growth rate of 18.4% over the past decade. Americans are indeed voting with their feet in favor of states like Utah that value lower tax burdens and more economic freedom. Once again, good economics produces good outcomes. As I travel the 50 states and give presentations to legislators, the business community, and taxpayer groups, inevitably the question will be asked, how has Utah been able to accomplish this remarkable feat of 14 consecutive years at number one? While the question is predictable, the answer is impactful for policymakers and concerned citizens in all 50 states. So how did Utah do it? As my longtime friend Stuart Adams, who serves as Utah Senate President and is the 2021 ALEC National Chairman, put it, for more than a decade, Utah has secured the top ranking for economic outlook in rich states, poor states. This validates the hard work and dedication of former and current lawmakers. Ranking as the most competitive state in America this many years in a row does not just happen by chance. Years of planning and preparation placed our state in a strong position to recover and succeed even in tough years like 2020. Our commitment to excellent policy drives our decisions and will keep our state moving in a positive upward trajectory. Senator Adams is absolutely correct. Good policy outcomes do not happen by chance. They are the result of substantial policy reforms, which in many cases take years to achieve. From creating a flat personal income tax with a rate less than 5%, to providing forward-looking public pension reform that enhanced the economic security for workers and taxpayers alike, Utah's policy reform set the bar high for other states. Even during the COVID-19 pandemic, Utah was one of the first states to provide much-needed legal liability protection for small businesses and frontline workers. Additionally, Utah's innovative truth in taxation approach to address property tax burdens adds real transparency, accountability, and honesty to the process that local governments use to assess business and residential properties. The law has reduced the cost of home ownership in the state since its adoption in 1985. Utah's property tax system has now become a national model, with my organization, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and now the states of Kansas and Nebraska following Utah's lead in 2021. In 2010, Utah state lawmakers took tremendous steps to fix the public pension crisis in that state. It was estimated that Utah's pension plan lost about 22% of its value during the financial crisis of 2008. Prior to that year, it had been the nation's best-funded pension system. In order to address the problem, Utah lawmakers offered a hybrid 401k-style defined contribution option to workers and worked to fix the unfunded public pension liabilities resulting from their old defined benefit plan. The reforms not only help protect future generations of Utah taxpayers, but also help to ensure lawmakers honor the promises that they made to public employees in their retirements. In summary, we find Utah's success is not based on federal stimulus, which always comes with costly strings attached, but rather fiscally responsible preparation, limited government, and free market policy that is conducive to economic growth and opportunity. With their major free market policy achievements in recent years, Utah's economic resume was built to be strong, and the state has become an undeniable model for states across America. For more information on Utah's economic success, visit richstatespoorstates.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KRNG-FM in Wadsworth, Nevada, WLSHAM in Nesquehoning, Pennsylvania, along with KSWHLP in Arkadelphia, Arkansas. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station.
Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.